Changes to federal H1N1 guidelines. Healthcare jobs there, but hard to find. And one hospital brings iPhones in for their nurses. Plus, we'll take a look at neuroassessments. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. I have a lot of things coming up in this episode, and I want to move into them very quickly. But first of all, I want to welcome all the brand new members to the show here. We have a lot of people adding, even as we go week to week, bringing in new listeners. If you're one of those people that's forwarding maybe the email newsletter to a colleague or recommending this to a friend, if you're a student, I want to just thank you again and continue those efforts. Talk about The Nursing Show on your favorite nursing forum or send it to a couple of your nursing friends in an email. Just let them know what kind of things are out there. We really need to spread the word about podcasts and tell them how easy it is to get shows like The Nursing Show and how much fun it is to keep up with what's going on in the world of nursing. Of course, to do that on The Nursing Show, you just have to head over to nursingshow.com, and you'll probably take a look over there if you haven't been in a week or so. You'll see that we've updated the look of the site. I think we've made it a lot easier to navigate. It's much easier to find out where you can just click to leave a comment on an article. And actually, we've had some really good articles this past week. In fact, I posted one talking about tattoos and nursing students and professionalism, and we had a lot of comments on that one. I welcome more, so if you want to check out that article, you'll find it over at The Nursing Show. And, of course, there's also a link now. Just click on the link for show notes, and it'll take you right into the show notes, starting with the most recent episode, and you can then go backwards from there. But you can check out all of the links to everything we talk about, and please follow up on those links and get the information you need to be the best nurse that you can be. If you want to send in a comment to me directly, you can leave it on the site, or you can always send it in by email. Send it into comments@nursingshow.com. Time to jump on into this week's news, and I'll lead off with the first story I talked about at the beginning of the show. The White House is looking at some possible changes in the guidance for the H1N1 vaccine and H1N1 safety, and really, this is coming in from numerous sites and organizations looking at the guidelines from OSHA and from the federal government on what exactly is needed in the way of personal protective equipment for healthcare workers when you are dealing with a suspected or confirmed case of H1N1. This came in from the Society of Healthcare or Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, and also the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, all sent a joint letter, I guess, to the White House to ask them to change the way that they're handling oversight for healthcare providers in hospitals, facilities, and in the field, and asking for them to change the way that the OSHA requirements are being enforced. This has to do with the use of fit-tested N95 respirators by healthcare workers rather than standard surgical masks. According to the organizations that sent the letter, these are not reflecting what is currently accepted as scientific evidence. Now, this is something that I'm interested about because we've had this discussion about N95 respirators versus standard surgical masks before, and there are two studies cited in this letter that are talking about the use of N95 respirators and saying that it doesn't offer that much additional protection than what was provided by standard surgical masks. And so we're getting a lot of conflicting information out there, but I think what these people are saying is that we need to remove that OSHA oversight, which gives a lot of power and kick to federal oversight for something that we should let facilities handle. And it can significantly increased costs as N95 masks continue to ratchet up in price. Standard surgical masks are going to offer similar protection, not the same level of protection, but similar protection, according to this particular letter. I'm curious if this is something that's come down in any of your facilities or organizations where you've run out of N95 respirators and had to resort to surgical masks, or whether you're just not following this guideline and just using surgical masks instead of N95 respirators. Those things are uncomfortable. If you haven't really worked at learning how to get a good fit and a tight seal around your face and mouth and nose, then they really don't provide the protection anyway if they're not worn properly, and they're uncomfortable when they are worn properly. So interested to see how this shakes out, and I'll try to follow up on this in future episodes. So we've had numerous articles covered here on the Nursing Show in the past on the recession-proof nature of nursing jobs, and then, hey, maybe it isn't so recession-proof after all. What is the difference? What's really going on? And I found yet another good article on this topic that I think probably clarifies why there's been a discrepancy in what people are saying. And this is from an article over at medicalnewstoday.com saying healthcare jobs are there, but they're kind of difficult to get into, that there are plenty of healthcare jobs out there. This is according to an Associated Press report. And they're saying that, you know, people that are looking for getting into the nursing field or other healthcare fields are thinking that there's a ton of jobs out there. And apparently there are more jobs than previously thought, but it still is difficult to get into these positions, whether it's because of a lack of training or because the positions require a certain level of skill or experience. And you know, you can't just come in as a brand new person and take, as an unskilled person and take a job that requires special training or a certain level of experience to handle patient care issues and healthcare topics in a workplace. So I think this is just kind of explains a little bit about why there's been a discrepancy about this. And this, I think, extends even to student nurses. Many hospitals don't have a choice and have to bring in student nurses and train them quickly and bring them up to speed. And most schools are good about turning out competent nurses who are able to operate safely and be strong enough, strong-willed enough, and confident enough in themselves to ask questions when they need to. But that doesn't take the place of having a person who's got 3 or 4 or 10 years experience on a med-surg floor. You know, they just, we're going to see a lot of tricks of the trade, a lot of knowledge, and a lot of understanding of what's going on from somebody with that kind of experience when you compare them to somebody who's brand new. So I just found this article interesting. I urge you to head over and take a look at it for yourself. And of course, always, I'd love to hear back your comments. If maybe you're a new student nurse or will be soon and are having that struggle finding a job, what kind of steps are you being told to take by your school in helping to find you a position? So how many of you are sick of those got an app for that ads that we see for the iPhone? Now, I'm an iPhone user. I love my iPhone. But, we know they've got an app for that. They've got apps for everything, right? Well, how about this? You know, you need to hear about your patient's labs and are they done? And those labs could be sent to you in a number of ways, but you can get them on your iPhone because that's right, there's an app for that. In fact, an entire hospital in Florida is piloting a program to bring all of the nurses iPhones. It provides them increased connectivity, provides them the ability to talk to each other over the server through voice over internet or voice over your intranet server, and also gives you the ability to text message each other and send information around the hospital using a new mobile application called Volt. And I hope I'm saying that right. It might be Volte, V-O-A-L-T-E, in this particular article. But it's talking about that they're giving out 25 iPhones or iPod Touches to a group of nurses on one floor in the hospital. And they're going to be using this new application to spread information, use text messaging, use it to call back and forth or contact people back and forth within the hospital, send information about specific patients, schedule things for different patients, all of that from a single device in the pocket of the nurse right there. She can look at imaging studies. She'll be able to bring up a lot of information. And the advantage of this, of course, is, first of all, it'll quiet the hospital environment down. We won't have to page on the radios to each nurse where you're calling out and every radio goes off when you're looking for a specific nurse. It'll also bring information directly to the nurse that you won't have to go searching after her, and she will be able to query the system for other information if she needs it. This is a great way to look forward into this system, and I'm hoping that this is something that gets picked up by other facilities because it is really a way to stay on the cutting edge. A lot of physicians I know have both an iPhone and a BlackBerry. The BlackBerry because the hospital requires it for connectivity, or their practice requires it for connectivity, but then also they have the iPhone because they just love having an iPhone. Wouldn't it be great to bring in a system where everybody can be talking to each other, and this provides that type of tight-knit networking to be in place? We'll have to see how this goes. This study is supposed to start off early in 2010. Time for this week's tip of the week, and we'll be talking about neuroassessment, kind of review those skills here. There's a lot to this, and I would urge you to follow up on the resources as always, because you really need to dig into more in depth if you haven't really done a lot with neuroassessment in the past. This is just going to be an overview, a review of some skills maybe you've already had, or just to refresh some knowledge for you about some basic neuroassessment skills. Neuroassessment is really comprised of a couple of different things. We look at cerebral function. We're going to look at the cranial nerves very briefly, and this is going to be kind of it because we've covered that in another episode segment, so you can look for that. And cerebellar function, and finally muscle tone and motor function, range of motion. And those are the big parts of neuroassessment. Let's start off with cerebral function. Cerebral function has to do with our higher brain functions, and so obviously, this includes loss of consciousness or level of consciousness and orientation, and sometimes Glasgow Coma Scale may be brought in as an assessment tool. Level of consciousness, are they alert? Are they alert only to a verbal response or to a response to pain, or are they unresponsive? Orientation has to do with the ability to orient oneself to a person, place, or time. And so you'd want to ask patient questions or engage the patient in a conversation where you could draw out this information about, do they know who they are, their full name, not just their first name, but give their full name. Do they know where they are and why they're there? This is, again, looking at their understanding of the place and what time is it. Ask them about the month and the year of what it is. And a lot of people say, you know who president is. Sometimes people get that wrong, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a disassociation with time. It just means they don't know who the president is, which is a whole other issue. Memory, short, medium, and long-term memory is also assessed here. And short-term memory, for purposes, I've seen a couple of different ways, up to 6 to 12 hours in time frame from the present. But again, short-term memory. Medium-term memory is going back from there to about 5 years or so. And then long-term memory is before that, back to early childhood. And so you can draw these information out from the patient and assess this in the course of a normal conversation where you ask them if they understand why they're there. So they remember the events leading up to coming to the facility or coming in to get checked out. Do they, you know, where do they work? Ask them where they live. What do they do for a living? This is medium-term memory, and then you can go back into long-term memory by asking them, tell me about where you grew up and what kind of place it was, or where were you born? These kind of questions are long-term memory questions. Finally, we have the three A's, and I include these all together and actually do more in depth, but they are agnosia, apraxia, and aphasia, and these have to do with, these are pathologies associated with an inability to perform some higher brain functions or some skills having to do with a recognition of things around us or of the ability to describe or understand language. specific things in the three A's. This is the inability. Agnosia is the inability to recognize an object using any the five senses. And this may be specific to a particular sense, which would localize it in a certain part of the brain. And this could be recognizing a particular scent via the nose, or putting a triangular shaped object block in someone's hand and asking them to describe the shape with their eyes closed. This is, again, they can should be able to tell you it's a triangle or a block. They should recognize what the basic object is. And you know, these are just some things to ways to test agnosia. Apraxia is the inability to carry out purposeful movements. So you would see, you know, maybe large motor function, and we'll talk about testing that later. But, you know, large motor function, they're able to move their whole arm, but that purposeful fine motor skill is not present, and having an inability to carry out that motion. And then aphasia has to do with understanding or expressing oneself using written or spoken language. Receptive aphasia has to do with the inability to understand what someone's telling you. So if you were talking to your patient who had receptive aphasia, they would be talking to you and making complete sense, but they would also become very frustrated because they would not be able to understand what you were saying, or in cases of understanding written language, they would be unable to read appropriately, but they could write written language. Broca's aphasia, or expressive aphasia, is the opposite. They can understand what you're saying, but when they go to answer a question, it is gibberish that comes out. It is an inappropriate collection of words or sentences or things that don't have to do with the topic at hand. What about cerebellar function? This is our larger broad motor function, large motor function, and also testing of balance. So we want to do some things that are testing rapid or alternating movements just to see if they have some large motion and fine motor control associated with that. Fingertips to nose alternating from arms outstretched to the side, and then bringing them in one at a time, and then back out again, fingertips to the nose. Heels to shins. I learned this back in the day from a nursing instructor, and this is taking your, if you're sitting on the edge of an exam table, taking your heel of one foot and just running it from the knee down the shin to the foot, and then doing the other side. And this points out, of course, that we want to assess these things bilaterally because we could have function decreased on one side versus the other. Romberg test. The Romberg test is basically a test of balance. You have the patient stand with their feet together. They have their arms outstretched or slightly outstretched to the side, head slightly back and eyes closed, and then see if the patient is able to maintain their balance in this position. Now, obviously, if you're testing someone that you suspect may have a balance issue, you need to be ready to straighten them or support them, because we do not want to have a patient fall and all of the associated paperwork that goes along with it. So make sure you're taking care of protecting your patient when doing some of these tests, if they have to do something like test their gait or their balance, you suspect that they have a problem with their gait or their balance. Pronator drift, you see this a lot in some of the stroke scales, Cincinnati stroke scale tests for pronator drift. This again is done with their eyes closed. They can do this seated on the edge of an exam table, sitting up, eyes closed. They're going to hold both arms straight out in front of them, palms up, and with their eyes closed, hold them there for a period of time. Pronator drift occurs when one side starts to drift downward, or the hands, you'll see pronator drift, that pronator motion where the palm starts to turn inward and down because they can't hold that up, palm up position for very long. And again, gait assessment is important to see what their gait is. If you watch them walk and they're drifting off to one side, that's a sign that that side is weaker than the strong side. And they'll be pushing. Just think about it this way. The strong side is going to push somebody to the weak side. So if they drift off to one side or are always falling to one side, that is a sign that side may be the weak side. What about motor muscle function? Well, we're looking at large motor groups here, and we're also going to be assessing muscle tone. And this would be something that you maybe have already assessed the patient, and you're going to do some ongoing assessment to see if there's a return of function or a return of strength in the muscle groups. You want, ideally, for the patient to show you that they can do the full range of motions. You're going to be testing, but not only muscle tone and visually inspecting and palpating the muscles, large muscle groups, but you also want to also have the patient, if they can, put that through range of motion examples. And can they do this on their own? And can they do it against resistance that you would provide some light resistance to their motion? And if they can push against that resistance, that's a sign that they have some strength in that arm or leg. So you will, again, assess muscle size, shape, and tone. You want to have the patient try to put that that limb through full range of motion. And again, you want to do all these things on both sides and assess both sides separately, but comparing them to the other. Pushing and pulling against the large muscle groups is a way to assess their strength and function. And you ideally want to do this both sides as well. So they would push, let's say they're seated on the edge of an exam table. You would put your hands down on top of their feet near the ankles and have them push out towards you gently, or you're going to get a face full of teeth, of foot up there. So have them just push against your strength. And then you'll cup your hands behind their heels and have them pull back towards themselves while you pull back against that. And you're trying to see if they can pull against the strength you provide. You want to compare these bilaterally. That's why I recommend doing both sides at the same time. Gives you an idea of one side is significantly weaker than the other. Again, you can assess this way. And you want to use some kind of a reproducible scale. There's a scale I've seen in a couple of places, a scale of 5 down to 0, 5 being strong and 0 being flaccid in muscle tone and in resistance testing. So let's talk a little bit about that. We want to use this reproducible assessment because it's obviously A, reproducible, and B, is easy to understand. Doesn't have a lot of levels to it, just pretty simple levels. And hopefully the same person will perform this test. So maybe this is something that would be done by a clinical nurse specialist in an area that would be regularly checking the patients maybe every day or every other day for return of some motion or strength in one side or the other. 5 out of 5 is the normal range, normal movement. They can rate full range of motion against gravity, and they can also push or pull against resistance. 4 out of 5, again, full range of motion on their own, and maybe they have some moderate resistance applied, but they can't really pull against strong resistance. This may just be a strength issue normally and not a sign of a deficiency, but that's why we put these two in the normal range. Paresis, or weakness in a limb, would be assessed as a 3 out of 5, where they can do full range of motion, but maybe only against gravity. If you provide any resistance to them, they can't do anything beyond just lifting the limb and moving it themselves. 2 out of 5 is they can move their extremity, but not against gravity very strongly or at all. 1 out of 5, the muscle, you can see the muscle contract, but they aren't moving anything. So when you say, I want to see you move your leg, and you can watch the large muscle groups, the quadriceps, tensing, trying to pull or trying to move the leg, but you can't see any motion, that's a sign that they have some muscle control, but they're unable, due to weakness, to be able to move. And then 0 out of 5, nothing's moving, no visible muscle contractions at all, completely flaccid. Remember to review all of the links in the show notes. Really follow up on that information. It'll give you a good in-depth look at some of the finer points of neuroassessment. And in the meantime, I urge you to check out all of the other links at nursingshow.com. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information, because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. time to close out this episode. As always, I'll be using a song from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This is a song by the artist Natalie Gelman and her great tune, Never Had You. I urge you to check out the links in the show notes, purchase Natalie's music, and let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show and that you appreciate her sharing her songs. It's a great way to support these independent artists. In the meantime, I will remind you as well, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
It's a